right, hour three on Wednesdays, we normally talk with Dr. Aaron Carroll, and today is part of the norm. We're very happy to have him join us for the hour, and I hope that you will as well. 866-994-6343 is the phone number, and yes, I still have to read it off a piece of paper, and I have it pasted all over the place because I'm an idiot and I can't remember anything. 866-994-6343. I'm at Pete Dominic. He is at Aaron E. Carroll, and the newest addition with his partner Austin Frack to the New York Times Upshot. He's also blogging every day at theincidentaleconomist.com, and we haven't even mentioned his day job, which is at Indiana University School of Medicine. And what do you do there exactly?
I'm a health services researcher, but I have lots of jobs.
Health services researcher. What other jobs do you have?
I am a director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research. I'm director of the Center for Pediatric and Adolescent Comparative Effectiveness Research. I'm the assistant dean for research mentoring. What else? I guess those are most of the big things.
I was just
Is that a horse?
Yes, that was a horse. I also raise horses.
He has a horse there.
Horse farm, yes.
Yeah, also as well. I was just there and rode some of those horses.
That's right.
Yeah. Or they rode me and they were his kids. What a wonderful family.
Thank you.
The boys and daughter. I was just in Indianapolis, where, by the way, I was performing in Indianapolis. And Aaron Carroll came on stage and told a hilarious story, did a little stand-up himself, although I still haven't seen that video that your friend Todd took. I'd like to play that on the air. I was going to play it today.
Oh, you know what? I haven't seen it either. Yes, he's got to get on that.
He's got to send that over to us. Very funny.
Yes, I would like to see it.
All right, there's a ton to talk with you, as there is never a shortage of issues to talk about, myths to debunk. One other job you didn't mention is author. He is also a contributor to a number of different outlets where he writes pieces like CNN.com and Journal of American Medicine Association. And of course, he's got two books, Debunking Myths, and about your body and your health. All right, there's plenty to talk about. Quickly though, I want to make sure that we mention your healthcare triage video, another job.
There you go.
The YouTube healthcare triage. This week it's marijuana. And you did a whole video about marijuana. Of course, it's 420. What are the findings? You know, and talk about, Aaron, talk about that article that we looked at your computer, about that study that maybe was a bit misleading, which was really surprising. It certainly misled me.
The study's not misleading. This is one of my big pet peeves.
The article's about the study that are misleading.
Media's coverage of the research that's misleading. So there was a recent study published, I think it was like the Journal of Neuroscience or something like similar named to that, where they got together a small group of people, like 20, some of whom were marijuana smokers and some of whom were not, and then they did brain scans, and they found some small differences in their brains in certain areas. And then, you know, the media took this and then ran with it and said, hey, we just proved that marijuana changes your brain, it causes neurological problems, it's horrible. You know, even small casual users have big changes to the brain, it's got to be illegal, look what it does, it's terrible. And there were some selected quotes from the authors which seemed to support this assertion, and this became the new study. I just heard somebody played me a clip of Chris Christie basically use this study to prove that, you know, but what about the children? We got to keep it out of their hands. And then I read another interesting article, which I posted actually on our blog, where they actually sat down and talked to the authors of the study for an extended period of time without selectively quoting them, and the authors were somewhat chagrined. They're like, my God, this is completely misrepresenting what we do. First of all, none of this is causal. They can't, you know, this was just they grabbed people at random and said, let's check this. So they don't know whether, you know, certain people with certain types of brain patterns like to smoke marijuana, or certain people don't. In other words, the causation could be in the opposite direction. The second thing is that these are small, subtle changes in the brain that they have not linked in any way to behavior or actual, you know, problems in life. There's a big difference between, you know, finding something on a brain scan and then actually seeing something happen in real life. And so they weren't saying this causes neurological problems. They were just saying, like, well, here's some differences in the brain. So they didn't in any way say, oh, we've proven that it causes actually behavioral issues or memory issues or any problems that would affect your life in any way. They also It's a very small study. They don't know whether it, you know, would be repeated, whether it would hold out to be true, how big the impact is, how anything else would happen. And so the media went and just took off with this, you know, another proven study to show that marijuana, you know, is going to change your brain or screw it up and all this other stuff. But my biggest issue with stuff like this is anytime I see a study like this that has to do with marijuana and, you know, impact on life, I always, the first thing that always kicks into my mind is like, yeah, but is it worse than alcohol? Because, again, is it there? How many times have you heard like alcohol kills your brain cells, or you know, how many people are killed each year because of drunk driving, or how many lives are, you know, 80 some thousand people a year die from binge drinking. You know, the economic impact is in the hundreds of billions of dollars. I'm not arguing we should make alcohol illegal, but it is just that there are plenty of substances in life that can have damaging effects if you use them the wrong way, including fast food. But the metric for legalization in this country is not no harm whatsoever. It just has to be a high enough level of harm that we think people can't make rational, good choices about them. No one argues that we should let kids have the stuff. No one is arguing that it shouldn't be regulated in some way. No one's arguing that you should be able to drive under the influence. You know, if you're impaired, you should not be driving. Same goes true for alcohol. No one is arguing that, like, you know, it couldn't have some negative effects, like smoking tobacco causes, you know, lung cancer. The question is whether the marijuana is in some way more dangerous. So finding a study, even if this bears out, that shows that smoking marijuana can have a negative health consequence, it's whether that negative health consequence is so massive that we can't allow people to even choose whether or not they want to use it. And again,
would you?
I just don't understand why alcohol and cigarettes would somehow pass this test, but not marijuana.
Now, you, I spent the weekend at your house. You have a lovely house with a number of shower heads in one shower. And that's how you know you're doing well. But you have a fridge.
Yep.
Like I do, an extra one. You have a big family, freezer. But your fridge is full of beer, and I'll argue it, mostly terrible, terrible beer.
That is and so not true. You have
terrible beer. This guy's fridge is full of Pabst, Rolling Rock, and Schlitz.
See, that's what you wanted. See, everybody doesn't understand. That's what Pete wants to drink, but I do not have.
No, I love gumball and dirty.
You can't even say what it is. You don't remember. It's not gumball. Try again.
I like dirty urine. What was the name of that one beer?
That was Urine Trouble. These are all beers by Three Floyds Brewery, which is a local brewery in Indiana. It is awesome and wins many, many, many awards.
Would you ever take one of those beers and drink it, much less two, and get in your car and drive your kids to practice?
A beer? I think so. Because again, it's
two beers.
Two beers is to drive. I don't know. I mean, we're getting closer to. I mean, but a part of it is like you make a judgment call. But I would not take a chance with driving my kids around now.
So when we talk about marijuana and driving, I think we also need to differentiate there
because there's no stigma
to having a beer and driving. Right. And I think that when people talk about marijuana and driving, they're still very terrified about that. But if you have a puff or two, or three, even, I mean, it's who smokes an entire joint or bowl or tons of hits of a bong and then gets dry. I can understand where that would be of a concern, but there is still a difference. What studies do we have on marijuana and driving? Did you take a look at that with this video?
There are studies that show that people that it is associated with a higher risk. However, the risk is significantly less than that of alcohol, but it's real. But I think it's important to say that, like, you know, even before breathalyzers were on the street and easy to use, the police had come up with ways to figure out, you know, tests to see on the road if you were impaired. Some of it was silly, like driving seemed silly, you know, walking in a straight line, touching your finger to your nose. But there were tests for impairment, and there would be tests for impairment, I imagine, now. And in the same way, again, there are risks. The studies show there are risks of driving impaired with marijuana. It increases the risk of an accident, increases the risk of a fatality, much, 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 much less than that of alcohol, however. And since I don't understand, you know, necessarily why people can make these same arguments perhaps about marijuana and have them hold water.
When comparing cigarette smoke to marijuana smoke, that's about an hour and a half lecture. But what do we need to know about that?
Well, there's just, like, no studies at all that show that, or, like, I shouldn't say that. There are lots of studies that show that smoking marijuana has almost no impact whatsoever on lung function. But smoking cigarettes do. It has really no impact on, like, the risk of getting, you know, lung cancer, but smoking cigarettes do. And so if you're trying to go for, you know, it's going to hurt your lungs or it's going to cause cancer, that's just not really proven. But again, even if there is a tiny, tiny, tiny but real risk, so much less than cigarettes, and yet we are totally fine with those being legal and marijuana not. And I can't say this enough. The bar for legalization, the bar for letting adults choose is not no risk, no negative health consequences. Lots of drugs have negative health
consequences. In that case, zip lining to be illegal, and it's about time somebody
did
something.
So many things have a risk. It's whether the risks are so great, so massively great, that we can't allow adults to choose. And I don't understand why when we say so great, that is a relative argument, not an absolute, but a relative argument. And at that point, we have to start weighing it against other things. And we have good examples of other things that are legal. Guns are legal. And I'm not saying we shouldn't let guns go. We shouldn't be banning guns. But if we recognize in this country that things can be legal, even when they carry risk.
Jesse in Virginia, you're on Stand Up.
Hey, good morning. I agree, Dr. Carroll and Pete, 100% with you both. As somebody who works in the public health field for a local government, it's really hard to be able to do anything. You can't get out and do a campaign that you know, says, hey, don't smoke pot and drive, because that would somehow be seen as legitimizing the use of an illegal substance. So as a result, the conversation, you know, gets skewed, because it's hard for somebody to be able to find kind of that legitimate voice to say, hey, if you're going to use responsibly.
Well, no, wrong. I only interrupt you because you're wrong in Colorado. We interviewed a guy named Mason Tvert, which aired last week. Go back and listen to it. His entire campaign for like 10, 15 years that he started in Colorado was because it's safer than alcohol. The entire point he made, because it was the most convincing argument, is kind of the argument that Dr. Carroll is making while he wears his legal hat and his health hat, of course, here, but which is, hey, why is marijuana illegal and alcohol legal when marijuana is far safer? Mason Tvert even challenged the then mayor of Denver, now governor, and the head of Coors Brewery, which, of course, is in Colorado, Pete Coors and John Hickenlooper. He said they could bring drinks, he'd smoke marijuana, and they'd see which one was more damaging in the moment. And so he did launch that campaign. I'm not sure if that's what you're saying can't happen or not, Jesse, but I just wanted to mention it.
I'm just saying it's very difficult for a public entity, which is where most of our public health messages end up coming from, to be able to spearhead something like
Fair
that.
Enough.
You need that private voice. You need a private organization that has some legitimacy to be able to do it. You're not going to be able to come into Virginia, where I am, and come up with, you know, we're the pot organization and start promoting that and have some kind of legitimacy.
Thank you for the call, Jesse. Appreciate it. We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll. Call us, 866-994-6343. Every Wednesday in the third hour, we welcome one of the most intelligent, articulate health policy experts in the country, and we often talk a lot about the Affordable Care Act, but we've been talking a lot more about health, too, here in the morning version of Stand Up when Dr. Carroll joins us, and everything else that he studies and writes about and researches. Mammograms. You've got a piece up at the Incidental Economy. This is why we can't get the public to accept changes to screening mammograms.
Yeah.
This post must have received some negative attention.
You know, not as much as usual, to be honest. So it's like maybe either things are changing, or else it's just there are too many other things in the news right now. But New England Journal of Medicine had a paper last week. Some time ago, Sweden got together and said, we need to have, like, you know, the government review all the evidence of mammograms. They put a panel together to review it all, and then two of the panelists actually wrote a paper and put it in the New England Journal of Medicine. And they said one of the most striking things they found, I mean, a lot of it was reviewing evidence we've talked about before, the studies that show that, you know, if you take the screening mammograms have almost no impact in sort of the large big studies on actual overall mortality. If you take 1,000 women.
Hold on. You lost me. And I want to be very specific and not get lost. The screening mammograms.
In other words, giving women, say, age 50, because that was what the example they used. Mm-hmm. A screening mammogram every other year. And then following them.
What's a screening mammogram as opposed to just a...
Not high risk. Not like you have a problem. Not that you are like you have a certain gene. In other words, to take just women to do universal screening, to say, come into the office, we're going to give you a mammogram just to see if we see anything.
A preventative measure.
Right. We do it in this country all the time. We just give every, theoretically, they want to give, you know, every woman is above a certain age, 40, I think, in the United States, you know, mammograms all the time. And so, they said if we take 1,000 women, age 50, and we do a screening mammogram program, the studies show us if we do nothing, the studies show us that, five women, I think the numbers was, five of the 1,000 will die of breast cancer in the next 10 years. They show us that like 44 women will die of something else in the next 10 years, and everybody else will be fine. If we do a screening mammogram program, we may, and the evidence is conflicting, we may reduce that number from, remember, we're doing 1,000 women. We may reduce the number of women who die from 5 to 4, and that's a may, but it's pretty much just as likely that one woman will die of something else in the next 10 years. So even if we prevent a death from breast cancer, which is not necessarily everybody believes that's so, we don't prevent any overall deaths because that woman is, you know, likely to die of something else. So there's a tiny potential benefit, but a lot of the evidence shows us that we're not really preventing any overall deaths at all for screening, just a universal screening program of mammograms. And so I don't know, but we're doing, you have to remember, first of all, we're over-diagnosing a ton of people, because mammograms are 24, 25 more times more likely to have a false positive in this population than a real positive. Those women get biopsies, they could have secondary effects, they could wind up getting surgery for over-diagnosed cancer, they could have mastectomies, there can be life consequences or emotional consequences, not to remember massive, massive costs, not just to the government, but to individual people who also have to pay for their health care. So there's a lot of question about whether the mammogram program, screening programs are worth it, because we also spend a ton of money on it. But the big problem that they noted, and this is sort of the new addition, was they pointed to a study which has been done, which asked women, what do you think mammograms do? And remembering that what I said before, that 5 of 1,000 women would die over the next 10 years if they didn't get the mammograms, they asked women, if we had 1,000 women and we don't do mammograms, how many women do you think will die over the next 10 years? And they said, on average, 160. So instead of believing that 5% of people would die, I'm sorry, half of 1%, 0.5% would die, they thought 16% of 50-year-olds would die of breast cancer in the next 10 years if there was no mammogram program.
Is that surprising? And why would you even – why does that matter? What people – just the perception?
Because then the next question they said was, if we do the mammogram programs, what do you think will change? And they said, well, half the women will be saved. So they thought that that number would be halved. Now, if you believe that 16% of women are going to get breast cancer, of 50-year-olds are going to get breast cancer and die of it in the next 10 years, not that 16% are going to get it. If you believe that 16% of 50-year-olds without screening mammograms will die of breast cancer in the next 10 years, and that doing the mammogram program will save half of them, if those were the statistics, I would be screaming that we have to do this immediately. Everyone should be screaming that we should do it. If you believe that, then absolutely, positively, a screening mammogram program makes 100% of sense. We absolutely should have it. And that is what, it turns out, lots and lots and lots of people believe. And if you believe that when the reality is nowhere near that, of course it's going to be hard to change people's minds, because they think that you're taking away a life-saving measure for something that is massively, massively common. Just unfortunately, that's not the case. And I talked about this before. We even made a video about it. You know, women are almost twice as likely to die in this country of lung cancer than breast cancer. Breast cancer is not even the most common cancer killer. And heart disease kills something like almost you know, 8 to 10 times as many women every year as breast cancer. There are lots of cause, many more women die of other causes than breast cancer. But if you ask women, you know, this study showed 16% of women, women thought 16% of 50-year-olds would die in the next 10 years. If we just sort of let things go in their normal course, and that the disconnect between people's beliefs and what they've been led to believe versus what is really occurring and at risk for them is massive. There's a huge disconnect.
And that is the case with so much of what we believe, and part of why you wrote two books.
Men are guilty of this and things like prostate cancer, lots and lots of things. So people just have huge misperceptions about what's really I could list these things off on this show. You know, we've talked about how people are panicked about the difference between organic and regular food. People are worried about they're going to get, brain cancer from their cell phone. People are worried that, if their kids do this or do video games, they're going to suddenly become violent. You know, these are not real, or they'll get autism from their vaccines. These are risks that aren't even real at all.
Well, I played Call of Duty with your son while I was at the house, and as soon as we got done, he actually shot me in real life with an M16.
He tried to kill. Well, that's because he was on orders to do that. That had nothing to do with it.
Oh, all right. But people believe things that aren't true all the time. Nothing, and you decide in this case what is true, and that's what people resent about you.
I don't decide. I'm telling you what studies and research show. So again,
well, you're cherry picking your studies and research.
Go out and find the ones that prove me wrong. I mean, these are systematic reviews and meta analyses, which have absolutely
HPV will kill your daughter.
Oh, it. Let's see. Okay, you're bringing this up because we just did this last week.
Now, so here's the deal. My wife sent me an email and said, we need to talk about this. I have some concern about it. Have you looked into it? And I have no concern about it. And I have looked into it. And I looked into it far more based on the links that she sent me. And so my wife and I have had a discussion about it, and it's going, I think, very, very well, by the way. But the point is, what she sent me was some crazy stuff that people have been posting on Facebook. What was really interesting to have was that I was in Dr. Carroll's home as we went through these links. And I think the most interesting thing that you mentioned was the insert on the Gardasil drug, which is manufactured by Merck. You're certainly no shill for the pharmaceutical company, Dr. Carroll, but that is the drug that some women are claiming has killed their daughters, and I'm not sure who's covering it up and so on. But when we looked at the insert, and you read the insert, and I can't read an insert. I don't even know what language that's in when it's talking about these randomized controlled studies and so on. It talked about the 19 deaths and the 21 deaths of 39,000 or something women tested. It was so enlightening to hear that. Do you think you could package that right now?
Yeah, so basically the article that everybody had been quoting said that Merck knew and the FDA knew that, you know, 1 in 900 women who got Gardasil died, and that no one cared, and that since the incidence of cervical cancer was so much lower than 1 in 900, that we were going to kill more women by giving them Gardasil than would die of cervical cancer, which sounds scary on its face. But what happened was we clicked through the link and I looked, and it was odd because that link went directly to the Gardasil insert. In other words, the information that comes packaged when you get the vaccine, the information everybody can see publicly. And I said, well, that doesn't make sense, because I mean, if they'd proven that this drug was killing 1 in 900, first of all, I didn't believe it, but if they said 1 in 900 women, so I looked, and what they were doing is as part of getting approved, they gave, a huge number of women, tens of thousands, the drug, and then followed them for side effects. And they did a randomized controlled trial. So let's say 21,000, I think, got one arm and got the drug, and like 19,000 or so, or whatever what number was, didn't get the drug. And then they followed them to see what happened. And it turned out that I'm not be precise in the numbers here because I'm quoting from memory, but I think like 21 women in the Gardasil group died, and 19 women in the I didn't get any drug died. And they found that.
And as soon as you said that, I was like, oh my gosh, it does kill people. That's exactly. I go, it does kill some of these people, I thought.
No, I said, but the first thing to know is that was 0.1% in both groups. So there was no difference in death between the two groups. But even then, some people will say, oh, but 21 girls died. But then if you kept reading, they listed the actual cause of death of each one. And, like, a couple of them were from gunshot wounds, homicide. A couple of them were car accidents. A couple of them were, you know, they had other diseases. They had, an aneurysm. Somebody had cancer. Somebody had a heart attack. Somebody had some other disease. They had nothing to do with the drug. Like, I mean, I don't know how you could say that someone who got shot in a homicide is somehow due to getting the drug. I know it's 21 women died, and 19 women in the other group died, both of which were in relation with completely unrelated to the drug.
The woman who died in a homicide, you're not telling the truth. The reason she was there having sex with was because she was having sex with that man, because Gardasil gives women permission to have more sex. Had she not gotten the Gardasil, she never would have had sex with the guy who killed her.
That would be an awesome argument if there wasn't other studies that looked at whether giving the girls the vaccine actually changes their sexual behavior, and it doesn't. And, you know, this is another one. We did a healthcare triage video on this. I detail all of this stuff. I've written about it on the blog a number of times. All of these things have been tested and proven, but it just blew me away how, you know, somebody on a website could say 1 in 912 women killed by Gardasil, and so many people just say, oh, my God, that's such a... And even when I showed it to you, your first instinct was, oh, my God, they all died. But it's like, this is why, you know, you need to go to, I don't know, maybe you need people who can read and explain this stuff, or you need to go all the way. But again, if I've taken it this far with the argument to say, yes, 21 girls died, but they died for reasons completely unrelated to getting the vaccine, and they died in the exact same proportion as women who got the vaccine, which is how in randomized controlled trials we show that the vaccine does not cause death. Because if it did cause death, you would expect to see more deaths in the group that got the vaccine than the group that didn't. And scientifically, you would expect to see deaths that you could in some way relate to the vaccine, and we didn't. And if we don't, then this is a study which proves we can't find any reason to believe that Gardasil causes death. And yet it was being used to say exactly the same opposite, and tons of people just swallow it.
We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll. You can see all of these videos that he's making and share them with your friends as they debunk much of what we've been led to believe from our lives or experiences or bits and pieces of articles that might misrepresent studies or flawed studies. Lots of reasons why we come to believe what we believe, and how can we be more responsible? Well, one thing I think, Dr. Carroll, is, you know, I try to do, and luckily you're one of my closest friends, and I can annoy you by asking you a number of questions personally all the time, but having you on the program, I ask them publicly as well, is, you know, we can find what we want to find on the internet. We can find anything to shore up our predetermined ideas on anything, including cell phones can cause brain cancer. Yesterday, a caller called in and said, talk to me about something called chemtrails, that planes are spraying chemicals in the air and altering the weather and so on. Myth, conspiracy, bullshit. But, you know, I think that the way that we do research, doctors' biggest fear is the parent who comes in that's just been on, the patient who comes in that's been on WebMD.
I don't know. It's their biggest fear. I mean, I know some doctors, see, this is where it's like, I think that actually research pretty much shows that doctors' biggest annoyance is working with electronic medical records these days. But having said that.
Right. You want research for that. Yeah, I was giving you an anecdote.
That's where I'm from. It's like, but it's saying things like that's their biggest fear. I don't know that that's their biggest fear.
No, I just made that up.
Okay, I know plenty of doctors who welcome patients who are engaged and want to talk about this. I mean, I don't shy away. I mean, you can imagine, I don't shy away from this stuff. I'm more than happy to engage in patients who come in. And most of them, to your face, don't want to fight. The vast majority don't want to fight. They are scared, and they want information, and they are reassured when you're like, okay, yeah, I've read that, and I can tell you exactly why that's, you know, not true, and, you know, or something like that. And you hope that your doctors are, you know, conversant enough in the reasons that they're doing things that they can engage and explain why the benefits outweigh the harms. And again, no one should be, and this, it all comes around the same thing, no one should be under the risk that nothing has no harm, that things have no harm. Everything has some potential harm. Everything. It's a question is whether the benefits outweigh the harms. And when the harms are infinitesimal and the benefits are real, then the benefits outweigh the harms. And the danger is when we start absolutely creating crazy, nonsensical, not real harms, and then minimizing the benefits in such a way that all of a sudden it seems, when it's like, oh, well, you're never going to get measles, and the vaccine is going to give you autism, so don't get that. Well, that's not an accurate representation of reality. And when lots of people start believing that, we start having measles outbreaks and other, you know, vaccine-preventable illnesses start rising up again, because the harms are real. I'm sorry, the benefits are real, and the harms are infinitesimal and or non-existent.
Keith in New York, you're on Stand Up at K Kaplan, ladies and gentlemen, on with Dr. Aaron Carroll.
Hey there, Dr. Carroll. So I've been reading Sam Arbuthnot's book, The Half-Life of Facts, and, you know, not only is it hard for people to process data, but the facts are constantly changing also. So what do we do? You have a bunch of people that can't process data. They don't have, you know, necessarily the foundational knowledge to understand what a standard deviation is, let alone, you know, what the necessary components of the study are.
Right.
So do you ignore the people and just say, you know, these are the experts, we got to go with the experts?
Well, I think that the problem is that people use the word expert loosely, and they're defining a whole group of people that have a varying range of actual skills in different areas. And so, you know, there's a difference between sort of an expert who just sort of claims it and somebody who's sitting down and explaining to you exactly how something works and has a real knowledge of it. And I think that that also comes back to say, like, there's unfortunately difference in facts. A lot of what we consider facts are done from, you know, large databases or association studies or correlation studies, which can be flawed in many ways and should always come out with a huge asterisk that says, my God, we didn't just prove this one thing causes another, and there's tons of limitations to studies like this, and don't oversell what it is. But the media is incapable, it seems, of making that kind of qualification. And to be quite honest with you, so are lots of scientists, because scientists want to be famous. They want their research to have high impact. They want to know. And so, you know, you will see often a study.
Let's not cast aspersions on the ambitions of scientists.
Including me. I mean, everybody's guilty of this. And so, some, you know, when you start out, when you have a study and it has a, how many times have you read, like, we just figured, cancer cure, they figured it out, or, oh, this new antioxidant's going to, you know, get rid of aging, or, oh, we just found, you know, this is associated with that, or, like, this cause, and so marriage makes you die later, or something. You know, all of these studies are not proving, you know.
Marriage.
I don't think marriage
makes you die, though, is the correct
later,
word.
Later,
it doesn't
later,
make.
Later, makes you
yeah,
die
but it's
later.
I think you should have phrased it, marriage is a something different. Marriage makes you die. All right, sorry, Keith.
Marriage makes you die later. It's a good thing.
Level. Yeah, I'm talking on a much simpler level. If I told the average, you know, caller that calls in that the odds of, you know, two guests that Pete has on in a week having the same birthday are probably greater than 50%, which they are, you know, they would go, no, that's nuts. But the fact of the matter is we have a fundamental problem. We can't understand even rudimentary statistical, you know, problems that are put in front of us.
That's a numeracy problem, and that I don't disagree with you. That is real, and unfortunately it's higher than we could say. However, the media could do a better job of reporting, you know, if the media ran stories that said, hey, guess what? This is true, that the odds of this happening are true, you know, then we might see that, but they don't. They're, you know, they're running, and again, we're sort of getting off into a specific example, but they run studies that say, you know, meat's gonna kill ya. You know, it's like, you know, reducing meat's gonna save your life, or, you know, if you have alcohol, you're gonna die of breast cancer. And there's no qualification of saying, like, you know, how much of a difference, how big it, you know, mammograms will save your life. You know, how much? What are the potential harms?
I mean, you saw what happened with the New York Times article that you dissected very well that said, you know, kids age 2 to 4, you know, are not gaining weight. And, you know, it was just a teased out group that was meaningless. So, I mean, we're not going to, you know, get rid of the it leads, you know, mantra for the news. So you can't do that. What do you tell policymakers?
I tell people all the time, you have to just, you know, you have to pick and choose your experts and then pick ones you trust. And it's like, that can be different people for everybody. But in other words, you should not be getting, again, it's like a kind of thing where it's like, you know, there's a difference between, you know, I think what you read in the news, what you read on the front page of the paper, versus, you know, what you might get from actual single experts and people you trust. I also think that you gotta start recognizing at some point that people have expertise in different areas. I said this to Pete, you know, over last weekend. It was like, you know, you'll have me on to discuss health policy and health issues, but if you want to discuss the war in Afghanistan, you don't call me. If you want to discuss, you know, how crime is going to happen or how we might prevent terrorism, you don't call me. I'm not an expert in everything, but we treat some people on TV and some pundits and even some journalists as if they are expert in everything. And that's just not the case.
And that's why, you know, it's the converse of what I try to explain about how I host this radio program. And the idea that you listen to somebody for 3 hours on the radio and that doesn't invite experts on, that weighs in on these issues constantly, it's so anti-intellectual. It doesn't even make, it makes no sense at all. Mario in New Jersey, thanks, Keith. I was just thinking of you this morning when I was waxing my back, that you hadn't called in a couple of days and that maybe you hadn't been listening, but you always come out of the woodwork when the great doctor's on the air.
No, I always listen. But I'm offended by not being included in the follow list that you sent out.
Oh,
I thought I didn't. Let me take a look.
Me and Scott out of the loop. I know you have limited space, but
I'll do another one. I'll do another one.
Thanks, pal. So, Dr. Carroll, I read your repost about the Lancet study, the Wakefield Lancet study.
Yes.
And it's the autism study, linking autism to the vaccine.
Yeah.
Now, why was it published in the first place?
Because at the time, the world was slightly different. And I think you were more likely in the time when that was studied to get a case series. These days, the idea that you could get like a case series published as a high profile paper in a high impact journal is almost impossible. We tell people all the time that this, I mean, I tell my faculty all the time, like, don't ever write a description of a patient. That's never getting published at this point. But at the time, there wasn't much written. It was, he wrote, I think, very conclusively. There were, I think, like high power people on the paper, and it was something which was sort of growing in the background as a concern. It would be as if somebody came out. And again, it's harder these days, I think, to get this kind of stuff published because knowledge and our ability to sort of debunk this stuff is a little bit easier in some ways. But, you know, if somebody at the time had come out with a strong paper showing cell phones cause cancer or something like that, or, you know, soft drinks cause cancer, I think that probably might have gotten published too. Because, again, the journals want high-impact stuff. The journals want to get read. And this was a very, very high-impact paper, believe me.
Was there immediate pushback?
I'm sure there was some. It's fascinating because I've never actually looked into the, you know, the media consequences of what was going on at the time. But, you know, there were a lot of people who just wanted to swallow this. They were, they believed it or they were worried. And again, it's the same way the Gardasil stuff. It's like there's a lot of people who swallow or want to believe in some of these conspiracies or it fit their worldview or it fit what they were thinking about it. And
No, I'm not talking about the individuals. I'm talking about the professionals.
Well, again, it's like you have to remember he falsified and lied about the data. At least that's what the BMJ has uncovered. And so if that's the case, then he made it look compelling. If it is the fraud that the BMJ alleges, and it looks, I mean, their arguments and the work that that the journalist did uncovering it seems quite convincing, and I've not seen anybody prove that he was wrong. Then the data was changed to construct an argument that made it look real. And so I guess they felt that, you know, they were compelled to publish it given the fact that they gathered these patients and they had a story that looked real. Now, having said that, if we had a responsible media, they would have said what I'm saying. They would have said, okay, wait a minute. This is like just a case series of like, you know, 10 or 12 kids, you know, 8 or 9 of whose parents say they think that maybe it was the vaccines. There's no actually conclusive studies. There's no like randomized controlled trial to prove causation. This isn't even, you know, set up as a real scientific study. It was just a random selection, not even random. It was almost a self-selection of patients.
Mm-hmm.
That's an incredibly biased way to do a study. I would draw no major inferences other than perhaps we should do another analysis, which, of course, is what everybody in the world has done since, and none have come up with anything close to these results. So a responsible media might have covered this in a way that said, yeah, that's not what that paper says. That this is not proving anything. This is incredibly flawed, and it's not something we should take too seriously. And at best, you could say that this probably should, you know, at least make us think we should maybe do a slightly larger study to see if the results hold up.
Let me jump in here. At Mario J. Russo, thank you for the call. I just tweeted that people should listen to you and follow you and Scott at Home and at Kevin Cruz. Okay? Sorry about that. I actually did include you, but it cut you off. Yeah, it cut you off. It was too many characters. I didn't realize that. Sorry. All right. When we come back from our break, Dr. Aaron Carroll and I are going to talk a little bit about the Affordable Care Act. But in the meantime, if you have gotten insurance through the exchanges or the Medicaid expansion or any other way that the ACA or Obamacare provides it for you, I'd like to hear a little bit about your experience. But if you still think that it will be the undoing of America, I'd like to hear from you as well, just to make Dr. Carroll have to argue with you. I want to hear from you. 866-994-6343. The latest on the numbers for Obamacare. We'll be right back with Dr. Aaron Carroll, who's on Twitter. At Aaron E. Carroll. Follow him there. Watch the healthcare triage videos as well. They're fantastic. We'll be right back.
Big ideas, expert guests, a disturbing amount of attention paid to personal grooming. Stand up with Pete Dominic.
Well, Dr. Carroll is joining us, and he is the biggest celebrity on the program. Everybody loves when he joins us, and because of that, in my personal life, I get questions asked, of course, by my wife, arguments raised, and her friends, my friends, I have a couple, a friend of mine, Lisa, talking to her on Easter Sunday, had us over to her lovely home, and a lovely meal, and by the way, did you break Passover yet, Aaron? No, it's over when? Last night?
Technically sundown last, well, it depends. I mean, like, it was either sundown on Monday or sundown on Tuesday.
What did you eat?
I mean, it's just a base machine juice. Last night we had a gnocchi with red sauce and turkey meatballs.
Ooh, very nice. Yes. So, I wanted to ask you a question that my friend Lisa brought up.
Yes.
And it's about rotavirus.
Yep.
Rotavirus. And she was talking to me about how in 1999, I think, the CDC issued a warning that doctors should stop giving the vaccine. And it's interesting because rotavirus was not something that we had in this country, or it wasn't deadly. A few months after that, the vaccine was finally pulled and has never been reissued, even though a different company started manufacturing a different formula of the vaccine that was supposed to be safer. Anyway, that's what she says. That's what her claims are. And that's, she's also talking about this article in the New York Times that she sent me. What is that? What happened? Because, you know, the big concern is, well, yes, sometimes the CDC is wrong and they've approved of a drug that ends up killing people.
Well, they wound up pulling it because it started getting incredibly bad press. And so the problem was that people thought it was causing what's called intussusception, which is when, usually in small children, the gut sort of folds in on itself and can cause, it can be, first of all, very, very painful. In fact, I'm pretty sure my oldest had it at one point. Sometimes it spontaneously resolves. Every once in a while it needs like an air barrier enema, and every once in a while it needs surgery. And there was a concern that it was increasing the risk of intussusception in kids. And the latest estimates are that they think that, you know, depending upon the study, that somewhere between like 1 in 20,000 and 1 in 100,000 kids could potentially get intussusception from getting the rotavirus vaccine. And it's still, that sounds, I think, scary to many people, except when you realize, like, how truly small a 1 in 100,000 or even a 1 in 20,000 risk is. That is unbelievably small. Now, people will say, oh, but why should I get the vaccine? Because the risk of death from, you know, rotavirus is still pretty small. Not that many kids die of rotavirus. And it's like, well, okay, first of all, yes, but death is not the only thing we care about. Before the vaccine was put into place, I think it was something like 200,000 ER visits a year were caused by rotavirus disease. Something like 50 to 75,000 hospitalizations a year were caused by rotavirus. Kids got so sick off of rotavirus, they get so dehydrated, they would have to be hospitalized. they have to put on IV fluids, and a significant number of kids would get so dehydrated they would go to the intensive care unit. Some of them would suffer brain damage. And so, yes, the number of deaths may be low, but the number of kids truly affected by this, and I'm only telling you the kids that got to the hospital, you know, there would be, you know, families debilitated because, you know, kids would get horrible.
This is in America?
In America, this isn't the third world. Rotavirus is terrible. Rotavirus, I swear to God, if you're when I was a pediatric resident, you almost get like PTSD about it. I can smell rotavirus. Like, I know what rotavirus diarrhea smells like. It's terrible. And the rotavirus vaccine, if given properly administered, reduces the risk of getting rotavirus in the first year of life by like up to 95%. I mean, amazingly effective. And it prevents something like, what are the exact numbers? I'm trying to remember, but it's like prevents something like 75 to 85% of all rotavirus, you know, episodes. And it prevents almost 100% of severe rotavirus disease. So, yeah, the number of deaths, and it's like this is where, how many deaths are represented by how many cases of intussusception, but intussusception rarely kills. You know, even when it does happen, we can take care of it. So even if one in 100,000 kids or one in 20,000 gets intussusception, not all of them go to surgery, not all of them die, a very small number, versus, you know, remember, 200,000 kids going to the emergency room and 75,000 needing to be hospitalized, and a lot of them having severe dehydration that would require an ICU stay, some of them getting brain damage, and some of them dying.
Well, what about this? She writes, if every child, she says, it appears that in the United States, this is a vaccine given largely for economic reasons. If every child gets it before the age of 5, then that's a lot of parents calling out to work, out of work to stay home with a sick kid. Mm-hmm. It's a lifesaver in parts of the world that often don't give this vaccine because the government can't afford to buy it.
Well, okay, first of all, you have to remember that for all the terrible things I just said in the United States, diarrhea is like one of the number one killers of people worldwide. I mean, in the third world, diarrhea kills because it's not as if we can pop IVs in. Like, we can take care of dehydration reasonably easy in the United States, but diarrhea kills in the third world. So even when the original vaccine was pulled from the shelves because there was somewhat of a panic because of this intussusception issue, there were a lot of people fighting and said, oh, you know what, and again, that was really hotly debated, you know, whether they were overreacting. And the drug company and everybody pulled it eventually, but there was a lot of argument that, you know what, in the third world, this equation is a joke. The number of lives saved would so massively outweigh, you know, the number of kids that might get intussusception, that the idea
which
that
is doesn't kill
worldwide would not do that. Right. But even in the United States, the reason that it came back, I mean, think about it. This is a drug that got pulled from the shelves, and still they kept trying to bring it back and do things because, again, this is a no-brainer. Rotavirus is a terrible, terrible illness.
Are we vaccinating our kids for rotavirus today?
God, you know, this is where, like, I want to say, yeah, I think that there's a new vaccine, yes, and that absolutely they give it. But, you know, you sort of caught me in a moment when I'm not totally
all right, well, look,
positive.
All right, let me take a call real quick. I don't have a lot of time, and I appreciate you answering that question.
I believe it is. Yep.
Carol in Minnesota. Is it Carol?
Yes.
You're on.
Hi. Yep, I just wanted to chat with the doctor and remind him, I'm a fellow physician, I'm emergency medicine, and, you know, we have, I'm sure you remember from residency and academia, the amount of time we spend in journal club with very smart people, arguing with other very smart people, and no one being able to come up with a reasonable answer, despite spending hours reading the same, like, 7 pages.
Right.
And so I think it's an unfair expectation to expect our media to be able to do that job.
Well,
you know,
See, I'll disagree with you in the sense that, first of all, not most of the time you're picking articles that you actually want to have a debate over where there is some level of gray, because that's how we teach residents and that's how we teach, you know, doctors to actually think through the issues, is the articles that I would pick for Journal Club are not cut-and-dry articles. They're articles that there could be a robust debate over. The second thing is that often in Journal Club we wind up spending a lot of time arguing over nuances, like how is this randomized controlled trial not perfect? I do think that the media could be given just a couple points that they could stress every single time that would be huge, like correlation is not causation, that, you know, a secondary database analysis of or a case control study or even a cohort study doesn't prove something causes something else. And they could be taught the difference between absolute risk and relative risk, where they, where somebody says there's a 50% reduction, but the original risk was only like, you know, 1 in 100,000, then a 50% reduction is almost meaningless. And,
right.
they, you know, there's a couple of simple rules. That, I'm not asking them to parse, you know, was the instrumental variable used correctly in this, you know, comparative effectiveness study using a huge secondary database? I'm asking them to know the difference between, you know, a, an article which looked at 10 people and found a small, you know, but statistically significant association that's published in a small journal, and not leap and say, we've just proven that cancer can be cured. And they often, they do that far too often.
Great question, Carol. Great question, and really great answer as
she
well.
She has a follow up. I mean, I'm happy to, because I don't want to, you know, she asked. Like,
go ahead, Carol. Did you feel satisfied with it?
I think that that's a very fair response, and I think that maybe we could do a little bit more as physicians to at least discuss those big principles with our patients and say, you know, when we get someone with 17 stacks of studies, I'm happy to talk about each one, but let's talk about them in a broader sense.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be teaching statistics in my ED, but sometimes those extra couple minutes can make a difference.
And we should also recognize, I think you're bringing up a great point. We should also recognize that so much of what we do has no evidence behind it. And I will not argue. When people come to me and they say, I read a study in this, and I'm like, yeah, that could be like the most evidence we have on that topic, because we don't have, you know, large randomized controlled trials to prove this. So, you know, we have to weigh all of these things and try to add them up to get that. That happens so often. It's only in the rare instances when we have huge randomized controlled trials. And that's when I get passionate. Because, you know what, if we spend billions of dollars studying mammograms and we have huge randomized controlled trials of tens of thousands of women, that's the most evidence we're going to get. No one's going to do another 30-year study of this. And if we're going to ignore it at that point, then what was the point? If we're going to do 10 million studies to prove that vaccines don't cause autism, that's when I'm going to get passionate about it and say, no, this, on this issue, we have evidence. But I'm not going to get on Pete's show, and I'm going to start lecturing you about eating red meat and how you should never do it, because that's not what the research is inconclusive, and no one knows. And same thing, we have the same thing with food allergies. We have the same thing with lots of other, you know, topics where we just don't have good evidence, and we could argue about the research. And in those areas, then I'm going to be much more quiet, because I think we should have equipoise, and I think there's lots of room for debate in those.
What's areas. Equipoise? Big word.
Where you sort of think, you know, where you try not to pick one side or the other.
Oh.
You know, when you do a scientific study, all scientists should have equipoise. In other words, we're not hoping for one result or the other.
Carol, Dr. Carol, do you ever use equipoise in a sentence?
Usually not.
I appreciate the call. You know, the my favorite part about this program is when I'm a listener. What a great conversation between the caller and doctor just now, two doctors. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.
At Aaron E. Carroll. At Aaron E. Carroll.